If anyone asks me, I always say, go to the cheapest school you can find that has the best instructors. It's not about the name brand. Even though, like, if someone says, oh, I went to SVA, you're like, oh, cool. Like, you know that brand, but it, I don't know, it doesn't, does it really matter? I don't, as long as you have a good portfolio? No, I don't think so.
Get that many opportunities to talk to people who are still working in the motion design field that are like directors in the space. But I was a little confused. I know you're in Los Angeles, but then you have all these things about New York.
Yeah.
So are you in LA now or are you in New York?
I'm in LA. Yeah. I've been here for 5 years.
Okay.
And I grew up on Long Island and I was in New York until 5 years ago, basically.
Okay. All right. Very interesting. Okay. So for people who don't know you, Daniel, can you introduce yourself and give us a little bit of your backstory?
My name is Daniel Savage, designer, animator, director, artist, whatever you want to call it. I've been working professionally for about 15 years, I guess, and went to school for music, ended up switching to graphic design. And then I found motion design through that. Then I worked in Comedy Central. It was my first job out of school. That kind of kicked things off. Went into the motion design field for a while. Got a little bored of that. Went into interactive and like more like a experience type stuff. Got bored of that. Went into more film animation and then illustration, doing some more editorial stuff. And then now I'm kind of taking everything and mixing it all together. And that's where I am now. And yeah, been mostly independent for my whole career. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's cool. So I'm going to go back and ask you a few questions, if you don't mind. In regards to your job at Comedy Central, what did you do and how did you get that gig?
It was on-air branding. Mm-hmm. And it was, the funny story is I got the gig because I found remember MoGraph.net? It was like the message board.
Yes, I found remember very clearly. Yeah.
The Chris Scarlotta, the creative director, made a post there looking for designers. So I just responded to that. And then like a week later, I was working there.
MoGraph.net was the precursor to Motionographer, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're like old school there. You're like a pre-Motionographer. Yeah. That's super cool. I love that. I was
definitely a super fan back in college, just checking every blog I could get my hands on.
Right.
I guess remember Surf Station?
That I do not know, Surf Station. Okay. So we can put a time on this. When did you graduate school?
2007.
Okay. All right. So you see this job posting and was it a simple matter of applying and just nailing the interview and getting that gig?
Yeah, that was pretty much. That was it. Mm-hmm. It was pretty simple. Mm. Yeah. I don't know. It was kind of funny. I remember this is like probably a stupid story, but my mom was like, you better wear something nice. And I was like, I'm going to wear a hat just to show you that I'm in a cool industry. No one cares. I don't know. It's like a just 21-year-old rebel trying to be cool. And then you get the job and you're like, yeah, it doesn't, none of this matters.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's funny because, like parents are, they're like, hey, make a good first impression, like show up for the job that you want, right? And you're like, no, it doesn't work like that, mom. I'll tell you a funny story though. My younger brother, who only took a couple of years of college, and he wound up working for me for a period of time, and there was a job opportunity for him at this company. So he shows up dressed up in like a oversized suit jacket.
Yeah,
with slacks, and he like tried to make that appearance. And what happened was the guy who hired him, his name is David. David's like, you got the job, but never come dressed like that ever again. So they had a good laugh about it.
That's great.
So that goes to show you, sometimes you do have to dress for the job, but not always what you think. It's not the uniform of business attire. It's to say, I have a perspective in the world and we like that, especially in the creative field.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. How long did you last at Comedy Central?
I was permalance there.
Oh, okay.
And like 9 months in, they were like, you either have to go staff or hit the road. And I was like, all right, I'm out. But yeah, it was super, super awesome job and learned a lot.
Yeah.
But then it was like, I don't know, I was excited to work at the studios and, you know, to see what that was all about. And so I worked at like Superfad. I feel like my whole resume is like studios that don't exist anymore.
I want to talk about that. So Superfad, are you in the Jake Banks era of Superfad or post Jake Banks?
Was he LA?
He is LA and he's the founder.
Okay.
I think, was it Matt Marquis who started the New York office? Maybe.
I'm not sure. I don't remember. I was only there for, again, it was like probably a 6 or 7 month run, yeah. You know?
It probably was. I feel like 2007, it would still be under his guidance. Anyways, let's move on from that. I want to take us back in time. Before you're studying music, before you find graphic design and then motion design and do all the stuff that you're doing now, when did you know, at what age, and what was the catalyst for you to think to yourself, I want to do something creative with my life?
I don't think there even was one. I think it just was always there. I thought I was going to be like a Disney animator. Is what my dream job was as like a child. Mm-hmm. Or just like cartoons in general. I wanted to kind of work in entertainment, I guess. And then I just lost interest in it and started playing music. But I don't know. It's always interesting to hear people talk about like, oh, when they realize that I can make money from doing this. And I don't know, maybe it was like an arrogant thought process, but it was like, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to make money. There's no question. It was like, that was me at like 10. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do that. Mm. What's the worst that could happen?
What is it about you or your parents or your environment or your culture that said, yeah, you can be a creative person. You can make a living doing this. No problem.
Yeah. I wonder if it is like just encouragement from my folks. Actually my dad passed when I was like a kid. So maybe there was also this like thought when that happened, that was like, oh, life's short. Like you grow up real quick and you're like, life's short. I'm going to do whatever I want for the limited time I have. Mm-hmm. So that could have been a big part of it too. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And then my mom has always been, whatever I do, she's stoked about it. So that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
I have to imagine, like, how old were you when your dad passed?
12, I think.
Oh my goodness. That is really young. Okay.
That was brutal.
Yeah. I mean, how did that impact, how did that impact your family? Cause I still have my father, and for my family, my dad was, both my parents worked, but he was the primary breadwinner and he was the stable force in our family. Like, without my dad, it's like, what direction are we all heading? And he was a disciplinarian. He was a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And how did that impact you and the family?
Oh, geez. I guess if anything, it made us all closer. Man, I don't know. This is like it's so weird. I've never really talked about this. Well, that's like just an interesting question. Never like thought about it. How did it impact us? I don't know. It definitely fucked us all up a little bit, but then made us stronger long term. Like pretty impressed that my mom kept everything together and we're all like successful and have like happy families and everything. But yeah, it was like, my dad was always smart about long-term thinking. And so like he had set up enough to like where my mom could still just be a mom. So like that was helpful. And I don't know. I don't even know what else to say about it.
Okay. So let me see if I understand a couple of things that you're saying. When you say us, do you have siblings?
Yeah, I have two sisters.
And what is your birth order here?
I'm in the middle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did either one of your sisters react in a stronger way than you did? Or
no.
Or because the story is with my dad, he has 8 or 9 brothers and sisters. his dad also passed relatively early, mm-hmm. and he had to assume the father figure for the family. So it changed his personality. It changed how he carried himself. So I don't know. I'm just fascinated because I don't know either one of my grandfathers. They passed before I was born. So all I know are grandmothers. And so I'm just curious because you're in a place where you actually, there was a time that you know before and the time after and how things change. Did anybody in your family, like your siblings especially, did they react one way or the other?
I don't know. You know what's the craziest thing about that whole situation is that I feel like leading up to it and then like the next couple of years, it's like you almost just like black it out of your memory completely. And then it just becomes your normal and then you don't really remember life before it. Mm. I mean, I'd say like I started rebelling and, you know, dressing crazy and everything like that. But like, would that have happened regardless? You know, I don't know. That's something I've never really thought about, I guess. But I guess, yeah, I guess my older sister's always been kind of more of the second mom of the family, you know? And mm-hmm. I've always just been the weird middle child who just kind of goes in the corner and does weird creative stuff that everyone's like, well, what's he doing over there?
Right. Fellow middle child here. So I feel the vibes for sure. I feel it, you know? So it sounded to me like your dad prior to passing was good with the finances and didn't put you guys in a weird position, which added some stability. And so his passing created a backing, but you guys came together as a, mm-hmm. as a family and made it through together in your own ways, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Like, I mean, we were far from rich or anything, but he had like a steady government job. He actually fixed computers for like a lab in Long Island. So that also was what got me into computers early was he would bring home spare parts and build a computer for us to like mess around with. So I was like on AOL 95 and all that, just screwing around.
People are like scratching their head like, what are we talking about? AOL who? Internet, if you're like under 20 years old, you won't even know this company AOL, but at one time they were a very big and important company. And it's how many Americans connected to the internet using dial-up even, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, in the late 90s, early 2000s, we're just talking about the beginning, the dawn of internet 1.0. Not to talk about internet 3.0, but mm-hmm. you know, that's kind of where we were back then.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I'm finding a lot of parallels between your story and my own because my older brother was really into computers. And so we had the very first IBM PC that was available and it was grossly underpowered by today's standards and super expensive. I think it was over $3,000.
Jeez.
And we were doing word processing on it. Everybody let that sink in. It was a big deal that I can actually type something and undo, you know, and revise what I wrote. So it's kind of interesting how fast technology changes. But
yeah.
So your dad introduced you to computers. You had access to computers. So this became part of your normal day-to-day interaction, right? You weren't afraid of these things.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. I feel like everyone in my high school thought I was a hacker just because I understood the internet. It was like, and everyone, they were like one by one slowly joining. And I was kind of a troll. And I was really into like programming, like little punters that would like kick other people offline. Did you ever hear about those? I don't know. It would send a crazy HTML code. It was like in bracket H33333 or something like that. Font equals H333. And then it would just send that through the IM chat and it would freeze the other person's computer. And so I don't know. I had a lot of fun with that. But that also like what introduced me to like Visual Basics and like very, very simple like C++ programming. Mm-hmm. But then obviously the Photoshop part of like, or the design part of creating those little punters was more interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think you did more with the computers you're given than I did because I mostly played video games and dreamt about making things, but you actually made stuff. So that's pretty cool. Another thing that you said that I want to underscore here is about this message that you picked up as a 12-year-old that life is short and like you don't know when you're going to lose it. So why waste it doing something that you don't love?
Mm-hmm.
And from looking at your biography here in terms of the different things you've gotten into, I think you've followed that to the T, where you're like, I'm into music, I'm going to do this. I think percussion, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm into illustration, I'm into fine art, graphic design. So how do you know from your own kind of internal compass or radar if this is a worthwhile pursuit, or do you just follow your heart?
Yeah, I think I just blindly go for it.
Yeah.
I mean, and actually what's interesting about that is that's why I think I change my interest so often, is because like I get into something and I go all in without thinking of the bigger picture. And then I kind of get to a ceiling or the end of the path. And I'm like, wait, oh, this is the wrong path. And I go back. And I think like, you know, that's a kind of, I guess it's a good thing because you pick up all these different things that you can apply to the bigger picture. But I should take a step back and think more. But yeah, I kind of just go for it and hope for the best, I guess.
Mm. I'm going to reveal something about myself. In no way should you feel pressured to reveal something about yourself, but I'm seeing parallels, right? I have a pretty obsessive, addictive personality, and that's why I stay away from drugs and alcohol, because when I find something I'm really into, I go really deep. I do that deep dive and I don't care about anything else. So when I'm into like fishing, I'm like buying magazines and books. I'm reading, I'm talking to every single person. I'm looking into buying tools and things to make my own fishing flies and things like that. I'm buying multiple reels and all the gear in the kit. And then I reach saturation. You call it ceiling. It's like, I'm done. I'm good with this. What else is new and interesting?
Yeah.
Can I do that? Yeah. Does that sound like you?
I think so. I get discouraged with side hobbies. Like, so I got the guitar right here.
I see.
Like, I started learning the guitar because I'm in an apartment. I can't play the drums. So I was like, oh, I need something to be a creative outlet. So I started that. And then but now I'm into trying to learn how to surf. And that's, I'm completely uninterested in learning how to play the guitar. I'll get back into it eventually. But I dabble a lot. I'd say more so than going fully in and hitting that end. Yeah.
I see.
But that's more with like hobbies. I guess with the art and work stuff, it's probably closer to what you were saying with becoming obsessed with it. Mm-hmm. But like right now, I'm like, and I think the reason why Greg kind of introduced us was like right now I'm completely obsessed with NFTs and Web3 and where that stuff is going. So that's like my obsession right now. Yeah.
Okay. I want to definitely talk to you about NFTs. I want to stay on this whole dabbling thing. All right. Yeah. So oftentimes I'm telling people that I'm working with, I'm trying to coach them, like, you know what? Pick your hobbies carefully because you only have a finite amount of time. You want to focus, mm-hmm. whatever it is you want to do, I don't care. But focus in on those things and get really good at something and have that discipline. So you learn something about yourself. It builds self-esteem. It builds character. And you seem to be okay. I'm going to dabble with this. That didn't work. I'll try this. What is the internal narrative in terms of like what's happening inside your head when you try something and you don't want to pursue it anymore? How do you give yourself permission to say, you know what, that was actually not that interested in that right now. I'll come back to this later.
I think it's more so I get really into it briefly. And then to be honest, it's probably usually just work gets busy and then I take a break from it. And then it's hard to find that motivation to jump back in because you're not in like a routine of playing of both just with guitar specifically playing every day. So that getting back into that habit is really hard, you know?
Some people, that's all they do. They just keep dabbling and they never find anything to go deep in. Some people are super hyper-focused and don't dabble at all. I think it's a mix of these two things that actually gives us joy, mm-hmm. but helps us to build enough authority or expertise in what it is that we want to do.
Yeah, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So all through your life, it seems like you knew what you wanted to do and you had the self-belief and self-awareness that, you know what, if I'm going to do this, I'll be successful. I'm not really concerned about that. And it seems like you've manifested that into reality. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about your work. So I kind of look at your body of work as a combination of a couple different things. And I'm going to say it the way I see it, but then I'd love for you to describe it in your own way. It's kind of hand-drawn looking, lo-fi illustrations that are combined with cell animations and some of these Memphis-style patterns. If you don't know what I'm talking about, it's a design thing. So mm-hmm. how would you describe your aesthetic?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds right. I think it's playing into my limitations and like exploiting them to try to find something that I can make my own rather than avoid something because I'm not good at it. It's like make it bad on purpose or something. I don't know. So, I mean, I'm probably like the most confident about my work is the rhythm of the animation. And that just comes back from playing drums, I think. But then the design part is always like, I don't think it comes as natural. I feel like I'm going on a tangent here, but yeah, I guess so the point being like, oh, I'm going to take that insecurity or limitation and just try to own it and not shy away from it, I guess.
Yeah. I like that. So let me see if I understand this. So, I mean, you're saying an idea that I feel in slightly different words. So playing into your limitations and not worrying too much about the things that you're not good at. So it's like, if I don't want to do 3D, I'm going to just focus on hand-drawn or cell animation or things I can control, right? And then trying to develop something unique that comes out of that place. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, I'd say so. Mm-hmm. Which actually, it's funny going back to the dabble thing. I did start learning Blender and then work got crazy and I stopped it. But
that was like during that period where you're like, I gotta bring 3D into this.
Exactly.
Yeah. I saw on your website something about something Savage IPA. And at first I was like, is this a real thing? And then at the bottom, it says there's a 3D credit down there from a guy named Justin Laws.
Right. Yeah.
So I was like, oh, so this is definitely, I mean, is this an example of like, I have an idea. I know what I'm good at in terms of design, color blocking and patterns and printmaking. And then someone else could make this look like a 3D can. That's not my thing to do right now.
Yeah. Well, that was a real client project.
Oh, that's a real client.
Yeah. And they're called House of Cans out based in, I think, in London. Mm-hmm. And I think every month or every other month, they invite an artist to design the can. And then they like come up with a name based on it. And so they named it the something. So it's funny because it does sound like a fake like student project. You're like, oh, I'm going to name it after myself. But but they came up with that name. Mm-hmm. And then we didn't get like high-end product shots. So I just asked my buddy Justin to do some 3D renders for it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure because I was like, I think this is a real project and it's real canon. But then there's a 3D credit. So it kind of threw me off a little bit. So this company, they do limited release artist inspired cans.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty rad.
Yeah, that is really rad.
And I think they're it's just like a small storefront somewhere mm-hmm. in the city and they just like make their own beer and collaborate with artists. And that's it. It's awesome.
Same beer, different cans or different beer?
It's a different beer every, like they're constantly like experimenting and they'll have a beer that they'll collaborate with someone on. Yeah.
Oh, very cool. Someone asks a question, it's going to sound really weird. So how do you taste?
they couldn't send any because it was shipping to LA was just going to be too crazy or something.
so I never even got to.
I never even got to drink my own beer. I know.
All right. If you were to describe how you might taste as an IPA beer, what would you describe? What are the notes it's going to hit?
I'm just curious. Know. I'm not even a big beer guy, actually.
Yeah. Might it be spicy, fruity? I don't drink beer at all, so I have no idea.
I guess fruity.
Fruity? Little fruit notes there. It comes from a good hop. I don't know. I'm just making stuff I don't know anything about. But the illustrations that are on the can are so unique that I think it would just jump off the shelf. I mean, it might even attract a different kind of customer. I'm like, oh, hey, mom, I'd like to try this drink. I'm like, no, it's a beer. So there's something like really fun and attractive about it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
The other thing that you mentioned, which I'd love for you to speak about, and people don't fully understand it when I say this. When I was first starting out my company, there was a guy's name is Ben Lopez, and he was really into music and composition, electronic music. And when I started working with him, he just knew how to animate like nobody's business. And from that point forward, I always thought to myself, people who have a musical background, either playing instrument or composition, they can see rhythm. I cannot. And so the way that he would adjust the keyframes, I just couldn't even keep up with him. So at that point, I'm like, Ben, I surrender. you animate all of this. You're just way better at it than I am. I'll go do something else. I'll go typeset or something. So you mentioned before, like the rhythm of the animation because of your background in music and percussion. Do you know why it seems like people who are into music have a better job at animating or can do a better job?
Well, I guess first I wouldn't say a better job. There's definitely people who don't play music or
right.
way better animators than I'd ever be, but it helps. I think it's, yeah, because I mean, it's just timing, right? It's just like when you learn about, for example, like in playing the drum kit, there's something called ghost notes, where it's like little like accents that are in between the main. So it's like if there's a main beat on like one and three or something, in between that you could do like a eighth note here and there. That's like little accents, and like that, like just like that way of thinking definitely translates into, oh, if I need this circle to go from point A to B, you know, it can like hesitate for a second before it goes. And then it's the same. It's like almost exactly the same type of thing. And so if you do that for, you know, whatever, 10 years every day, like for like 2 hours a day, then it's just going to become natural to think that way.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, I'm probably going to butcher this, but like music is in the silence between notes. It's a spacing, right? And you're talking about this ghost note, and that's kind of interesting. I've not heard that term before, but when you talk about animation, I get it. Some of the things you're talking about is like anticipation and overshoot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so
sure.
We feel like we want it to move, and then it hesitates or pulls back, and then it moves, mm-hmm. and then it misses the mark, and then it comes back, and those are the kinds of things that I see really prevalent in the work of people who understand animation. I see it in your work, obviously, but it feels human. It doesn't feel digital and cold.
Yeah, definitely. And it's adding like a bit of style to it too, to give it that extra little whatever it is. The thing,
the je ne sais quoi, whatever that is.
Yeah, the thing that draws you into it, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, even if you are not familiar with animation or rhythm, you can feel it in your body when you're looking at the work. There's something really attractive about it. And if you study animation, this is what you do, you can point out, there it is. That's what it's doing. The motion curves look really good. It's speeding up here and slowing down there. But most definitely when you look at something that isn't done by someone who understands this, there's something that's off. It feels super digital and it doesn't have that kind of finesse.
Mm-hmm.
Time for a quick break, but we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Chris Gethard, and I'm very excited to tell you about Beautiful Anonymous, a podcast where I talk to random people on the phone. I tweet out a phone number, thousands of people try to call, you talk to one of them, they stay anonymous, I can't hang up, that's all the rules. I never know what's going to happen. We get serious ones. I've talked with meth dealers on their way to prison. I've talked to people who survived mass shootings. Crazy funny ones. I talked to a guy with a goose laugh, somebody who dresses up as a pirate on the weekends. I never know what's going to happen. It's a great show. Subscribe today, Beautiful Anonymous.
Welcome back to our conversation.
Switching gears, you started Something Savage in 2014. Is this your production company?
Yeah, it was me sort of escaping the in-house booking type work and trying to get my own clients. And I think at first I had ambitions to make it a bigger studio. And then as I started getting clients and hiring freelancers to help me, like if I was juggling a couple of jobs at the same time, I realized I was just being more of a producer than anything. And I would be jealous of the guy or girl I just hired. And
right.
And like, I'm like, oh, I want to be doing what you're doing. This sucks. That's also actually what drew me into the illustration type stuff. It was like the way an illustrator does business was really appealing to me. It's all project based and obviously you can do like a contract type booking, but here's the scope, here's what it's going to cost, and I'll talk to you next week when I have something to share. You know, and that was really appealing to me. And so I'm like, how can I take parts of that, but while still doing animation and not have to build a big production company? So it's like finding that middle ground of like where I can kind of fit in the cracks between the two different things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now when you're juggling more work than you can process, are you having to continue to work in that producer role, or are you hiring someone to help do that so you can actually do the work?
Yeah, no, it never really gets to the point where I need to hire a producer, but I'll hire friends to help me animate. Mm-hmm. Usually character animation is the thing that's my weak point, I guess, when it comes to animation. So I'll hire someone who's an expert at that I'm friends with, that I trust, and I don't need to babysit them, and I'll go back to what I'm doing, and then they'll check in whenever, you know. So it's like that type of thing.
Yeah.
But it's not that often. I try to keep a good work-life balance, I guess, mm-hmm. to where I can do the work I want to do without being too much of a manager, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You're in this position where I think a lot of people would love to be, where you got out of school, you did like full-time freelance, and then you kind of freelance around different studios. Sadly, many of them are not around today. It's fine. It's not your fault. It's like, you're not the angel of death here. Right. And then you're now an independent where you can actually have a direct relationship with clients and have the possibility of hiring freelancers to do what you used to do for other studios. How did you go about acquiring these relationships with clients? Like, I saw that you do work for Volvo. Like, how did you get that client?
That one specifically came through an agent who helps me find work. And that one came through them, and it was through Acne. It was an agency in somewhere in Europe. I can't remember exactly, but so there was some like layers there. I didn't actually get to meet anyone from Volvo. But I think that's also, you know, it's an agency job. That happens often, right? But yeah, they help a lot. But I've only been on their roster for like 2 or 3 years, maybe two. Uh-huh. So before that, it was just being in Brooklyn for 10 years and like meeting lots of people and, you know, word of mouth type stuff. And then you're just like, hey, I'm going to do this on my own now. And then people are like, okay, we'll give you a shot. Mm-hmm. And then lots of cold calling, you know, that type of thing. Just knocking on doors, seeing what happens. Mm-hmm.
I hear that story quite often, actually. People in New York, because it's such a tight-knit community and you can actually accidentally bump into all kinds of people. If you go to local watering holes, you're going to meet people. It's just how New York works. I think it's pretty unique and exclusive to New York, because I don't hear about that in LA. You don't just bump into people. We're very much a car culture here, based so far spread out. But you said something which raised my eyebrow. And cold calling? You cold call clients? Or tell me about that.
Well, I think the biggest thing was when I was like excited about illustration, and I was like, I think it's kind of like a classic illustration tale where you go to Barnes & Noble's and you take a picture of they list the art director in all the magazines. So just I went there, any cool magazine I found, I took a picture. And then I went home, made a spreadsheet, and just sent out a ton of emails. And then it actually worked. I don't know. It started, it was kind of slow, but then it just snowballed. And then, so yeah, I've tried just like finding random agency art directors and just be like, hey, what's up? Love to work with you. I don't think it really works that often, but I guess it doesn't really hurt either, you know?
Yeah. What you say sounds really simple, but a lot of people don't do the simple things and then they don't have these opportunities available to them. I've never done that. I never even thought to do that, to go look at the magazine, who's buying, who's deciding who to work with. And then you just go and reach out to them.
Yeah.
Not rocket science here, folks, but yeah. The basic stuff works, right?
Yeah.
And this is how you got leads?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So then you get these simple, like low budget, editorial illustrations, mm-hmm. but there's like a chance to like put yourself into the work and like have a lot of fun with it. And then you post it on Instagram or whatever. And then the agency art directors start to notice. And then it's like, you know, one thing leads to another. And then,
I see.
Then you don't have to go to Barnes and Nobles anymore.
All right. He's laying out Daniel's laying out the blueprint for how, if you're just coming up in the world, what you can do. You get a lead any which way you can. And he's suggesting just look at who's making the decisions, who to work with. And they're not tremendously high budget, so there's a good chance that you can get an opportunity. And then you document that work and then you post it on Instagram, because now it's a real project you're doing for a real client, maybe with a name that you know. And then that begets you the next opportunity. Is this now how you get the leads that you get, is through Instagram?
I don't know. Probably. Instagram, Twitter, or just like word of mouth. I don't know. It's, I'll get like random emails from people and I always try to like trace like where could they have found me, or like, or if, like if there's work of mine that's in the mood board, like, okay, like, oh, this is from this project, and you can kind of trace it a little bit, but mm-hmm. I think it's just kind of like just being out there, just doing it for a long time, and just, I don't know, it's like a weird thing.
It's not always so easy to trace back like the origins of where you get a lead from.
Yeah, and
it's tough. I mean, you can ask people like, oh, I think I saw you somewhere, and you're like, okay, where? Or somebody told you. So oftentimes, mm-hmm. if we want to repeat the success that we have to find out where these things come from, so we can put more effort there. Because obviously, if you love that kind of project and that kind of client, then you want to get more of what they got.
Mm-hmm.
I think you mentioned that you're represented by Acne as a production company. They represent you, or
no? No, it's Agent Pekka.
Oh, Agent Pekka. Sorry.
And yeah, they're more of like an artist illustrator rep.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, because it's not your typical production company that reps directors. And I think I like that a little more.
Mm-hmm.
There's no pitching, really. It's more just here's their work. Here's what it's going to cost. Do you want it or not? You know?
Yeah.
I've never been repped by a production company, though, so I don't have much experience to compare it.
Mm-hmm. It's not great. I'm just going to tell you, it's not great. Okay. Well, in general, we always feel this way, and whether it's true or not, we always feel like our reps aren't doing as much as they can to get us gigs. And we hear about, oh, Johnny and Mary got the opportunity to look at that project. How come we're not in the conversations? And who knows? There's a thousand reasons why.
Yeah.
But when you talked about, like, when you tell them, like, here's the price, either they say yes or no. Who determines the price? You, or do they work with you on this?
Yeah, they'll kind of, if someone emails them, they'll sort it out, get on a call, get details. Then they'll come to me and be like, it's actually pretty cool. They'll forward the entire email chain. So you're aware of everything that's going on. So it's like very mm-hmm. transparent. Mm-hmm. And then they'll be like, here's what I'm thinking. Does it sound good to you? And usually it's like, yeah, that sounds great. And then it's like up to the client whether or not they want to do it. Yeah,
that's really cool. I'm glad that you're able to do what you do, to have the kind of relationships that you have, and not have to pitch and go after the work and jump through so many hoops. That's really cool. Okay, now we're going to get to the part where I think we both want to talk about. And I think I'll try my best to bring it all together for everyone who's paying attention. So you mentioned that, I guess, in the late 90s, early 2000s, you're messing around with computers, you're you're writing like bots or code to like boot people off servers and things like that just for fun. And so obviously you're a guy who's comfortable with technology. The thing that's popping right now that everybody's talking about that's getting, they're all getting involved in this because there's tremendous opportunities for artists is none other than NFTs. I myself, I'm starting to go down that rabbit hole and I see that you have a collection. Tell me about your interest in NFTs and what is it that you see that you want to do with them?
Yeah. I guess towards the end of 2020, I feel like it was when everyone kind of started like paying it. It's been around for a while, but everyone started paying attention to it then. And in that moment, I thought I was late and I was trying to get on all the platforms and the waiting list was so backed up, you couldn't get on. But yeah, it was just, I don't know what it was. It's like something about it that made the internet fun again, I guess. And I guess maybe that's part of the whole Web3 thing. Mm-hmm. And so like I listed a couple things on the platforms on like, I think it was called Maker's Page and Foundation were two that I was on. And I was like, and I sold a couple things and it feels incredible to sell your work. But then it was like, there was like gas fees involved. So you're paying to list it. And there's no guarantee that someone's going to buy it.
Yeah.
So I got a little discouraged. And then this is probably more of a pandemic thing, but I was like, I can't deal with all the noise on Twitter. And I unfollowed everyone on Twitter just to like break the habit. And then like I left for the whole summer. I looked at Instagram, but I tried to avoid social media in general. And then I came back in October or November and started seeing all these that, then I realized what was happening with like the more DIY collection stuff where it's, you create your own smart contract and you build this thing and you don't have to pay the gas. And if someone wants to buy it, they pay the gas, you know? So it was like all the things I didn't like about it. Like there's no percentage that I think Foundation takes like 15% or something. So it's like, that's doesn't exist anymore. So it's like, oh, I can give this percentage to a developer instead and do it myself. And it's also just like this, the idea of generative art in general is really interesting. And like finding ways to do that with my limited coding knowledge.
Yeah.
So it's like all those things combined. I was like, you know what? Let me take a stab at this. I had my friend Mike Bodge helped me put it all together with the smart contract and the site and everything. And yeah, and it's interesting. I'm like totally hooked now. And I'm like, we're working on phase two of the project's called Infinite Grid and kind of interested to see where it goes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So for Infinite Grid, the things I've seen are parts of like animations that loop perfectly, I think. Right. Mm-hmm. And then compose in different configurations using some kind of engine where you adjust parameters to how often you see this, how rare this this trait is, right? And it builds that composition based on the variables that you provide.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It was a way to bring my interest of like, you know, back in the day, graphic design, grid, everything's grid-based, and that, trying to push that into an art expressive place. And then also taking traditional hand-drawn animation loops that I really love to create. And how can we use random codes to build however many unique renders based on that? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how has the reception been to the NFTs you've listed?
Good. I mean, we sold 700 and a little over 700 of them. And yeah, I don't know. Everyone that came across the project seems really stoked about it. It's a tough thing when you're just, because I took a break from the summer and I didn't keep building. It's like, you're almost like starting from scratch. So it was like a little tricky getting the word out on some of that. But now we have like a little community of like 1,000 people on Discord and that's slowly building and we're working on where to go from there and giving some rewards to people who bought the grids. And yeah, I don't know. It seems there's been pretty good feedback based on all that.
Do you think in the very near future, this could be your full-time occupation or obsession?
Maybe. I mean, anything's possible, really.
Right.
I don't want to go all in just in case it does dry up and like people stop buying, you know, and then you're stuck and you obviously, I still have like client relationships that I want to maintain and all that. But I guess it is like, you can be a little more picky with the clients that you take on.
Yeah.
Which is cool. So that is definitely helpful.
Mm-hmm. I talk to creative people about this all the time, that you need some cushion, and the cushion away from the peaks and the valleys of client work, because it can be very irregular. It's that expression, feast or famine. There's either too much to eat or I'm starving. Mm-hmm. So some form of passive income in the form of an NFT or something else can help to soften the lows. And so you can skate for a while. And if there's a client that you don't feel for whatever reason, you can just say, it's not right for me. You deserve someone who's going to give it 100%. I don't think I can at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
What's really interesting about NFTs right now is that the variety of what can be considered a piece of art is all over the place, from weird screenshots into really cool generative pieces of art. But I noticed with yours, it's really kind of fresh because it's non-figurative. There's no form. Like, it's grids and shapes and lines and abstract things moving around, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's actually going back to like not really thinking too hard on things. It was just like, this is the idea that came to me, and I just went with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool to hear that it's different, I guess. Whether that's a good thing or not, because maybe I'd be rich if it wasn't different, but
if your grid was on a monkey or something.
Yeah, exactly.
I'll just say it like that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's disproportionate in terms of like which NFT makes the big dollars, and then there's everybody else, right? It's like same thing in life and economics. There's a small percentage that just seems like they could do no wrong. And then everybody else is like, well, I wonder what my next drop is going to be like.
It's pretty funny.
I've enjoyed this conversation. I want to make sure I ask you this question before we get out of here, which is, you know, I want you to think about perhaps in your life, if there was a singular transformative moment, an inflection point where there was a before and then the after is so different. We talked about the passing of your father. That's probably an inflection point. But is there another one in your life where you're like, there was something significant there? Because I think there's opportunities to learn.
Probably switching majors in college.
Mm-hmm.
I guess like every few years, it's like there's like something that happens that pushes you in a new direction. And I think in college, it was changing majors. Then outside of college, it was living in Williamsburg and Brooklyn and being surrounded by super talented people that, and you're just like, you start pushing, you're like all my roommates were like really like rad, like music producers or other graphic designers and stuff like that. And so we would all just like work really hard and like push each other. So like moments like that, I guess a lot of it is really like who you're around in your community. That's probably a big part of it. Right.
Yeah.
So like when I was, you know, I got a little older and I don't want roommates anymore, then you get studio mates. And then the people that you work with at, in this like grungy warehouse in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, is now that those are the people that inspire you and influence you, and you want to kind of keep up with them. So it's just like, that's like evolution. Classmates, roommates, studio mates.
Take me back to that point. You're going to school. Is this at Sunny or SUNY?
Yeah, SUNY Purchase.
SUNY Purchase.
Yeah.
You're going there to major in music?
Right.
And was there a idea that you had, like, I'm going to do this with this education?
Yeah, actually. So this is funny. The same thing is like being inspired by someone and them influencing you. Like my percussion teacher in high school went to music school, then became a percussion teacher. And like now I'm learning from him and he's like super cool. And I was like, I want to be this guy when I get older.
Yeah.
So I was going to go for a performance degree and then get an education degree and then teach. And then also like try to make it as a performer. But the education was like the easy backup plan, I guess.
Yeah.
And very, very glad I didn't do that. But, but yeah, that was like the safe way to be a musician, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Would you be a drummer in a rock band or in some kind of big band? I mean, what was the idea there?
Well, I was studying like really avant-garde percussion ensemble work, mm-hmm. like really, really pretentious stuff. It was like super like pots and pans clanging and like,
oh, I
don't know. It's that was Purchase. Purchase was like really like art forward school. And I think that actually may be why I switched into graphic design, because it was too artsy fartsy for me or something, you know? But yeah, just to answer your question, I probably would have been playing in bands, gigging as a percussionist and then teaching. So it's like, mm-hmm. kind of like what I do now, where I'm like, just like all these different little pots, that like make up the big picture, you know?
Yeah. You know, when you said that, I don't know why, but I just had this flash. Have you seen Whiplash?
Yeah.
Okay. From your perspective, I mean, what is your take on the portrayal of like an obsessed drummer who's being brutalized by an instructor, and just to what ends this person is trying to pursue this life as a musician?
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I guess I didn't really have the focus that like is portrayed in that, but there were people in my program that had that focus, and they were in the studio all day long, just practicing the same four notes over and over again, just mm-hmm. to try like on like a marimba, just like trying to get it like perfect. And I'm like, yeah, mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, I don't have it like that. I can't do that. But then we did have a professor who, I guess he calmed down when I got there because he was a little older, but there were stories mm-hmm. that he would like throw drumsticks at people if they screwed up. And so it's, I don't think it's too far from the truth.
Yeah. I think the interesting things about these stories that we see is we sit there and we scratch our face or our head and chin and say, could that be real? But it's that's based on somebody's experience somewhere, mm-hmm. because that's what makes the characterization so believable. And I've had instructors like that, old school instructors, that would make you question your own self-worth all the time.
Yeah.
And it's old school. Like, we don't have those kinds of instructors anymore because it'd be borderline abuse,
yeah. you know,
or assault or something. But yeah. It's kind of fun to just watch vicariously, like, my gosh, that's what it takes to be at the various, very highest level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So you're going to study you're doing avant-garde percussion. You're going to gig, and then you're going to teach as a backup plan. What tells you now it's time to change? And how do you make that decision? Is it an easy one, or is it through like consternation, like, and consulting friends and family? Like, hey, is this the right thing for me?
Trying to go into my head as a 18-year-old. And it was, you know, I would go to class and I would learning these pieces of music. Okay. The biggest thing at the time. So I would go practice all day, study, go to rehearsal, whatever. And then I would go home and I would open up Photoshop and just start clicking around just for fun. And I realized like that part of the day was what I looked forward to. So part of me thinks that if I had gone to music for production, I would have stuck with it, because it was more of like you're a recording artist, you create something that you can like, here, check, look at this thing I made, versus performance where you spend 6 months studying a single piece of music and then you go, you play it once and then you never look at it again. So that's what I got out of graphic design, was I could create something and just be done with it. And then like, you know, put it on the wall and you're like, start the next thing. And that was a big part of it, I think. And the funny thing is that with performance, you can study something for, you know, the whole semester and then you perform it. And then you miss one note and it's the whole thing's ruined. Versus if I'm in Photoshop, I just hit undo. It's less pressure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating. I love that answer, by the way. So you have a life plan. You think this is what's going to happen. And you find out there's something you enjoy doing a little bit more in your free time. And then true to the to your arc is that you learn to listen to that. And you're like, you know what? If I enjoy graphic design and jumping on Photoshop, maybe this should be my thing. Mm-hmm. And so do you have to make a big decision to say, okay, I'm going to switch majors, and that means like I got to get paperwork signed, I got to apply to a different department. Is that a big deal, or is that a pretty easy, seamless transition there?
Well, I think it was easy just because it was the same college. I think if I had to transfer, that would have been a pain in the ass. I thought in my head, oh, I need to go to SVA or RISD or something. But then the more I looked into the Conservatory of Art at SUNY Purchase, it was like, oh, this professor teaches at SVA, and this person knows this person who works there, you know. So you're like, oh, this is probably like good enough. I don't mean that as like a jab at Purchase. I just mean like you get out what you put in, right? So it's,
yeah.
You don't need to spend. I mean, it was a state school, so it was super cheap. So I paid my student loans off really quickly, and I'm very grateful for that. And that's, if anyone asks me, I always say, go to the cheapest school you can find that has the best instructors. Because it's not about the name brand. Even though like if someone says, oh, I went to SVA, you're like, oh, cool. Like you know that brand, but does it really matter? I don't, as long as you have a good portfolio. No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. To answer your question though, yeah, it was just switching over was, I'm sure there was paperwork. I don't really remember it being that big of a deal, but a lot of my credits transferred from music to art, which is pretty cool, which actually also, I'm rambling now, but it kind of sucked because like I didn't have to do some of the entry level art classes, which I wish I had done, like life drawing and stuff like that. They were just like, oh yeah, this is, you don't need to do that. You're good. And I'm like, all right, cool. And then I ended up taking them later on my own. But yeah, that's the other tip is don't skip the foundation classes.
Yeah, I think sometimes the biggest learning happens in the foundation classes, which on surface seem like the most boring classes, and you want to get to do the fun stuff. But the fun stuff has more meaning and impact when you learn actually the core skills that you need, the ability to see and understand the form and render it, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Getting a little geekier, but yeah. So did you have to, did you have to tell anybody, like your mom, or just like, no, I'm just changing?
I'm sure I told my mom, and I'm sure in her head, she was like, oh man, all those drum lessons I paid for are down the drain.
Yeah, like a parent's nightmare. It's like, oh, all right. We're not going to do anything with all that, huh? Had to deal with the noise, the banging, the gear, the lessons, and graphic design is a very silent hobby. Why couldn't you have figured this out earlier? You know, you're killing me.
That's so funny.
I have two boys. They both had piano lessons, and only one of them is continuing on in that pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I'm okay with that. And I think the ask was, give it a couple of years, after which, you know, you know some basics and you decide if you want to pursue this or not. One of them, like, I don't think he's articulated to this to us, but he loves playing the piano, and this is, nice. I think it's going to be part of his life for the rest of his life, as far as I can tell.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah. Okay. This is awesome. I really appreciate you jumping on. I just want to be mindful of time. I really appreciate you jumping on the podcast, sharing a little bit about your story. Daniel, it's been a real pleasure. I want to wish you the best of luck in your future creative endeavors, including your NFT project, Infinite Grid. Where can people find out a little bit more about you? Where do they go?
Somethingsavage.com.
So simple, somethingsavage.com.
Yeah. And you check me out on Instagram and Twitter.
Throw more signs when you do that.
Yeah.
What is your handle on Instagram?
Something Savage. It's Something Savage across the board. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, you got you got lucky on that you can claim one thing across everything. So it's Something Savage on Instagram, on Twitter. And you're back on Twitter now, right?
I am, yes.
Yeah, because I know you took a break there.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. This is awesome. This is Daniel Savage, and you are listening to The Future.
Thanks for joining us this time. If you haven't already, subscribe to our show on your favorite podcasting app and get a new insightful episode from us every week. The Future Podcast is hosted by Chris Doe and produced by me, Greg Gunn. Thank you to Anthony Barrow for editing and mixing this episode, and thank you to Adam Sanborn for our intro music. If you enjoyed this episode, then do us a favor by rating and reviewing our show on Apple Podcasts. It'll help us grow the show and make future episodes that much better. Have a question for Chris or me? Head over to thefuture.com/heychris and ask away. We read every submission and we just might answer yours in a later episode. If you'd like to support the show and invest in yourself while you're at it, visit thefuture.com. You'll find video courses, digital products, and a bunch of helpful resources about design and creative business. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.